What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
And this is Morningstar Golly with Law and Disorder. On the line with us this morning is Phyllis Bennis. Phyllis is a Middle East analyst and directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Her book, Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, a primer, was recently republished in its seventh edition. Welcome to the show, Phyllis.
Great to be with you, Morningstar.
This is a new year, 2025. It's a new year for all of us. And what can Palestinians look to hope in the new year? And does this mean anything in terms of Israel's violence?
Well, unfortunately, I think what we're looking at right now is a continuation of the 15 and a half months of genocide and horror that Palestinians have been facing in Gaza ever since the events of October 7th. And the Israeli violations, the violation of the Convention Against Genocide, what many newly famous figures, people who we don't usually, you know, assume that this would come from them, are officially calling ethnic cleansing. That includes the ambassador of Algeria, who is now the president this month of the UN Security Council, who said that on Friday at a Security Council meeting. The former Israeli foreign minister, Ya'alon, are all identifying Israeli actions in Gaza as ethnic cleansing. That has not changed. There's now 45,500 more dead. 90% of the population has been displaced, most of them for multiple times. Hundreds of healthcare workers have been killed. The American Historical Association over the weekend passed a resolution condemning what they called scholasticide, the complete annihilation, deliberate destruction by Israel of the entire Palestinian education system from kindergarten right up through universities. All the universities in Gaza have been destroyed. Most schools have either been destroyed or are being used to provide some level of shelter for some of the displaced people. It's a disastrous situation, and we now see the escalation of not only famine, which is on the rise and has been, but also of hyperthermia. We know of six babies so far that are known. There's almost certainly far more than that, where parents can't get out to even report the death of their babies, who have died of hyperthermia because there's just no way to keep them warm in the very, very bitter Gaza winter. So the conditions on the ground have not changed. And unfortunately, here in the United States, while there is one reason for hope that I'll get to in a second, but in the meantime, there is a horrific reality that also hasn't changed. The U.S. provided $22.7 billion of military aid to Israel this year. That was in the form of their usual $3.8 billion that they've been getting every year, plus $14.1 billion more in direct military aid, and then another $4.8 billion worth of U.S. Operations that are designed to support Israel in the region. So the total is $22.7 billion, and that's providing 78% of Israeli weapons. It's covering 40% of Israel's total military budget. These are numbers that, when you look at any one of them, they just sound horrifying. And taken together, all it says is that we are complicit. Our government is using our tax money in our name to pay for this horror that Israel is carrying out. And that's alongside providing intelligence, providing direct involvement of US troops in operating anti-aircraft systems, among other things, providing vetoes at the United Nations. It's a horrifying situation. And the one thing that I think does provide us with a glimmer of hope, at least for the medium and longer term, if not for the immediate situation, is that the horror of all of this has led to the creation of not only a strengthened Palestinian rights movement, which has been very important, but also a much broader, wider range of people who have been part of the ceasefire movement, who for many of them never really identified much with Palestinian rights, never paid that much attention to it, perhaps even people who were bigger supporters of Israel, and are not necessarily people who begin or start with the same framework as the Palestinian rights movement, not talking about the origins of Zionism, not talking about the need to oppose imperialism, not talking about settler colonialism, but just talking about stopping this horror of genocide. And that movement, that includes the uncommitted movement, includes the people who have been resigning from their positions in government because they cannot bring themselves to be part of this. Most recently, the State Department's deputy political counselor for Gaza, Mike Casey, the most recent resignation. This is all something that we've never experienced before. This is all brand new this year. And it's hugely important because it's had a real impact on public discourse, on media discourse, even on the political shifts. So it's not enough yet. We have to do it better and more and consolidate that movement that is rather amorphous still, the ceasefire movement. But it does provide an incredible opportunity to recognize what has changed. The fact that some months ago already, 77% of Democrats said there should be no more US military aid to Israel. That's unprecedented. That's never happened before. Last month in the Senate, we had 19 senators, 40% of the Democrats in the Senate, voting for resolutions to condemn and stop, to disapprove is the official word, to disapprove of resolutions calling for more US military aid to Israel. Unprecedented. Again, it's not enough to stop it. And we know that just yesterday, just over this last 48 hours, the Biden administration has announced their intention to provide an additional approval for $8 billion worth more of weapons for Israel to be able to buy from the United States. So all of this is still going on, but we have the hope that comes from building movements. That's the part that I think gives me hope and that provides a little bit of hope for people in Gaza. It doesn't change the horrific conditions on the ground, but it does provide a bit of hope.
Thank you for all of that information, Phyllis. Yes, 15 months of genocide that we have all witnessed over the news and social media. You mentioned the vetoes with the United Nations, and I'm wondering, in terms of an international indigenous rights framework, what that means in terms of the ongoing vetoes and what that looks like. I know that there's a number of organizations that have been actively championing, and what that looks like in terms of what you were mentioning about the ongoing support and coordination.
Yeah, the work going on at the UN has been incredibly important, and I think that one of the things we have to recognize is that the United Nations General Assembly has actually done a great deal of what organizations here and elsewhere around the world have been pressuring them to do, which is to move towards implementation of, for example, the International Court of Justice's decisions. It imposed provisional measures calling on Israel to stop killing people, which is essentially calling for a ceasefire very directly without using the word. The court, of course, does not have, although its rulings are considered mandatory, they do not have the capacity to enforce them. They don't have a military force. They don't even have a police force. But what they do have is an incredible level of legitimacy that is global. And it provides, for those of us who are part of social movements demanding Palestinian rights all over the world, it gives us a tool to hold up to our governments to say, you know what, it doesn't really matter what you want to do right now. This is not a political issue. We're talking about international law. And international law requires that the Convention Against Genocide, for instance, be taken seriously by countries who have signed on to the Genocide Convention. Not only Israel in this case, which is the, if you will, defendant in the case, but every country that has signed the Genocide Convention, that certainly includes the United States, is obligated under the terms of the convention to impose whatever it can do to stop a genocide from occurring, to prevent it, and if it happens, to stop it. So what we have at the United Nations in the General Assembly is a move. They passed a resolution in September, very powerful resolution that actually goes further even than the provisional measures that were imposed by the ICJ, by the International Court of Justice. And in that resolution, among other things, it calls for an arms embargo. It says that there should be no trafficking of arms in either direction, either buying arms from Israel or selling arms to Israel from any country. So it's an incredible tool for moving on this. Any arms sales from the United Nations, from the United States right now, stands in direct violations of that resolution of the General Assembly. Now, the U.S. position, of course, for many, many years, and that of some other countries, we should be clear, is that General Assembly resolutions are not binding. They're just advisory. You know, they're not really very important. We don't have to pay attention. But it gives us a tool to say, look, this is the position overwhelmingly of the vast majority of the countries of the United Nations, of the entire world. And that's our job. So we have been given this tool by the General Assembly. This is what happened. The model that we should be looking at is the model of the South African anti-apartheid movement of the 1980s, where similarly, the United States, Great Britain as well, but particularly the United States, used veto after veto in the Security Council to prevent any kind of serious sanctions against apartheid South Africa, prevented an arms embargo, prevented the banking sanctions, prevented the corporate sanctions. But eventually, when the General Assembly passed those resolutions over and over again, every time the General Assembly looked at what the Security Council was doing, the Security Council was facing a U.S. veto, the GA, the General Assembly, would take it up and they would pass the same resolution. And enough countries individually began to take seriously their obligation to impose those kinds of sanctions, military sanctions, banking sanctions, corporate sanctions, that eventually the U.S. was under enough pressure from the fact that all of its allies, all these countries all around the world, were doing the right thing. And the U.S. finally gave in to that pressure. And the Congress, led by the Black Caucus of the Congress, was able to pass comprehensive sanctions in 1985. And yes, the Reagan administration vetoed it, but they were able then to get enough votes to override that veto and put the U.S. on the side of opposing apartheid, finally, after so many decades. So that's the model that we can look at. The fact that the Security Council faces these constant vetoes from the United States doesn't mean that there's nothing more to be done. The General Assembly is doing exactly what they should be doing under the Uniting for Peace precedent, as they have for many years. It's up to us to make those decisions somehow real in our own country. For us, it's the hardest anywhere in the world because it's our government that is carrying out those vetoes. And it's up to us to say, not only do we have to stop the vetoes, we have to get the U.S. into compliance with what the United Nations is calling for.
Phyllis, over the weekend, there have been new rounds of ceasefire talks between Israel and Hamas. What happened there?
Well, we don't know for sure yet. This is, again, what, the fourth, fifth, seventh, 17th time that we've been close, we're being told. We don't know. There was an announcement from Hamas of the names of former hostages and current hostages that could be released. The Israelis are demanding to know which of them have been killed. We know that some have been killed in Israeli airstrikes. But the big stumbling block remains the fact that Israel refuses to make a ceasefire deal that is something that will bring about an end to the war. The Israeli position is we will only allow a temporary halt in the fighting. And as soon as we have the hostages in our hands, we will go back to war, which is essentially saying to the Palestinians, we're going to keep killing more and more and more Palestinians. We are simply not going to stop, no matter what you do, even if you return the vast majority of hostages. So it's not at all clear whether this is going to go anywhere. The Biden administration, of course, is very eager to get some sort of a ceasefire agreed to, even if it doesn't work, I suppose, before leaving office. And the Trump administration coming in has said they have told Netanyahu, they claim, that they want a ceasefire before they come in. So on the US side, there's lots of support for it, but nobody seems prepared to put any pressure on Israel to actually agree that a ceasefire means an end to the war and not simply a temporary pause. That still remains the main stumbling block.
And last week, the director of the Kamal Adwan Hospital went missing and was apparently arrested by Israeli forces. What do we know about the attacks on the hospital, and what do we know about his whereabouts?
Kamal Adwan Hospital in Gaza was the last hospital that was, none of them have been completely functional, but the last one that was significantly functional, where they could actually carry out surgeries. The Israelis put the hospital under a siege for weeks. They were firing at it. They were killing people coming in and out. There were more than 50,000 people that were sheltering in the campus surrounding the hospital itself, as well as hundreds of patients and healthcare workers inside, many of whom have been killed. They then ordered out everybody about a week and a half ago, ordered everyone out, including desperately ill and desperately injured patients, including from within the operating theaters. Doctors were arrested. Many of them were strip searched and marched half naked in the cold to unknown places, taken into custody by the Israeli military. The director of the hospital was last seen being pushed into an Israeli tank. And while the Israelis have finally, under significant pressure, acknowledged that he is being held, they refuse to say where he is being held, what his condition is, if he is still alive. Too many prisoners being held, too many detainees that Israel is arresting have ended up being killed in custody. So we don't know his condition. We don't know where he's being held. His family has no idea. His lawyer is not being allowed to see him. And that's true of a number of other healthcare workers. Many have been killed already, as is true for journalists. But this has been an absolute assault on the healthcare system in Gaza. The Friday Security Council meeting, which was chaired by the new president of the Security Council for January, who's the ambassador of Algeria, was focused on this question of Israeli destruction of the healthcare institution, something that is a separate and complete violation of international law. And in that context, the people who testified included the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, as well as an extraordinary Canadian-Palestinian doctor, Dr. Tanya Haj Hassan, who has spent a great deal of time in Gaza hospitals treating patients and provided just a devastating account of what the effect has been of the Israeli assaults on the hospitals. It's gone on throughout all of Gaza. The particular target in recent weeks has been in North Gaza to make sure that people there's somewhere between 250 and 350,000 Palestinians left in North Gaza. And Israel has been very clear that their goal is to get all of them out. And one way to do that is to deny them all access to food, all access to water, and all access to healthcare. So the most recent attacks on the healthcare institutions and on the hospitals have been in North Gaza. So that's what it looks like right now on the ground.
We have been speaking with Phyllis Bennis, a Middle East analyst and directing the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Phyllis.
Thank you, Morningstar.
We will now go to our next guest. Our next guest is Samir Arabi, a member of the Arab Resource Organizing Center. Samir co-hosts the weekly Palestine Solidarity Announcements every Friday at noon here on KPFA. Welcome, Samir.
Thanks, Morningstar. Great to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. Can you provide us with an update? We just heard all of these, really, as it's been ongoing for the past 15 months, plus many, many, many decades, updates from Phyllis. Can you provide us updates of what you are hearing on the ground, that there are heavy rains currently in Gaza? What does that mean for people that are living in tents and displaced within the area?
Yeah, an absolute humanitarian catastrophe, as we know, and one that has been engineered. So no real surprises there. But the situation is specifically designed so that the sort of institutional resiliency that once existed in Gaza is no longer there. Right. So in addition to things like, you know, the tents not being well prepared for the rains, in addition to the freezing temperatures causing the death of at least now six babies and countless adults, of course, you know, we're also seeing the lack of potable water leading to the spread of contagious diseases, a completely failed vaccination effort because Israel continued to bomb vaccination sites across Gaza. And of course, you know, this idea of humanitarian safe zones, you know, relegated down to the area in the southwest, basically turning into extermination zones, right? Like corralling all the Palestinians possible into these areas and then depriving them of the basic infrastructure they need to sustain human life. And, you know, that doesn't even consider the additional military assaults on those so-called safe zones, which have been subject to sort of endless bombardments, drone strikes, bombings, tank incursions, you name it. You know, this incredible Palestinian legal NGO, Al-Haq, just came out with a report last week outlining the ways in which Israel has used these humanitarian safe zones as a tool of genocide. So I would definitely recommend folks give that a read. It's something we also went over on the PSAs this last Friday.
Thank you for sharing that information. Let's talk about the latest on the border issues with both Lebanon and Syria. What are current updates with that?
Yeah, there's plenty. There are big updates on both sides, frankly, both Lebanon and Syria. In Syria, you know, as folks probably know, Israel has seized a large chunk of Syrian territory immediately following, you know, the fall of the Assad regime. And that territorial incursion made a lot of, you know, news waves in those first few days, but folks may not be aware that it is still ongoing. And just as of 2 days ago, Israel has taken another pretty big chunk of southern Syria. They took control of a really important dam near Qunaitra. And, you know, there's actually an interesting through line here with what's happening in Gaza, because once again, one of the many core Israeli objectives here, you know, in addition to this, the naked land grab, in addition to the sort of, you know, colonial ambition to just steal whatever kind of area and resources they can take, water is a really clear through line here, you know, and you know, Israel seized and illegally occupied a chunk of Syria in the Golan Heights back in 1967. It's been holding it ever since. And now it's, you know, more than doubled that territory. And one of the reasons they took the Golan Heights back in 67 was that it provided sort of guaranteed water access that would have otherwise gone not only to Syria and to Palestine and Jordan, but continued downriver, like to other Arab countries, and now Israel takes all of it. And now they've just seized, I think at this point, six major water sources across southern Syria. You know, and the environmental implications of this and the human life implications of it are quite high. And this is, of course, in addition to the ongoing aerial bombardments and incursions that Israel is doing across the entire country. The aerial strikes that Israel conducted in Syria were the largest in its history. And, consider like all the unbelievable things that Israel has done in terms of how it's used its air force to, level cities and kill people. Never in its history has it done it at this scale. And what it's done is, they use this claim of, reducing like access to weaponry that could be used against Israel, but really they've completely destroyed the security apparatus of the state, right? So like, there isn't a single Navy ship left, there isn't a single airplane left. Every research center has been bombed by Israel. So like the idea of building a sort of centralized state now is feeling pretty impossible. And we're seeing the very predictable consequence of that with ISIS, re-emerging as a pretty serious military force now that there really isn't much of a military to counteract them. And this all feels, Syrians finally have an opportunity to live outside of this, like, not great authoritarian regime, but by all indications, things are not exactly getting better. And on the Lebanon side, the so-called ceasefire that was signed in November has been violated, dozens and dozens, if not over 100 times at this point by Israel, which just last week has now confirmed that, well, confirmed might be too strong a word, but has intimated at least that they will actually be keeping Israeli soldiers in Israel, in Lebanon, beyond the end of the ceasefire term. So, the deal that they signed gives Israel 60 days to remove its troops from southern Lebanon. And they've decided that no, actually, we're going to keep them there a little bit longer. So, no giant surprise there, but this sort of, land grab again in southern Lebanon, does appear to be something that the Israeli government is trying to hold on to for a little bit longer. And it's not clear what the consequences of that will be because, of course, the power that is arbitrating this ceasefire is the United States. And if the United States isn't going to hold Israel for, accountable for anything, clearly, then there won't really be any consequences for Israel to sort of defy the ceasefire terms and just hold on to that territory. And whether that will lead to the resumption of like a hotter war than we're seeing right now, there's still this sort of cross-border missile exchange kind of thing. Israelis continue to murder Lebanese civilians in the south. But it's very possible that things will get heated again. The 60-day ultimatum actually closes out in, I think, 10 days or so, sometime in January. So there isn't much more time, and we'll see what happens when that closes out.
We have been speaking with Samir Arabi of the Arab Resource Organizing Center, AROC. Thank you so much for joining us. Samir, can you share with us about the Syrian overthrow of Bashar al-Assad and how that has developed? What is it that we have learned about how it will relate to Zionism and Israel?
Oof, that's a big question and a really important one. It's of course, something that we're all thinking about quite a lot. It's a very divisive issue, for a lot of people who I think, we talked about this quite a lot on the Palestine Solidarity announcements, the ways that, folks need to balance these two ideas of anti-imperialism and anti-authoritarianism. And so there's no question, I think, that the fall of Assad, is like a boon to the Syrian people in the sense that, he wasn't exactly a great leader. And, we saw the sort of in the emptying out of those prisons, particularly Saydnaya prison, the sort of unimaginable conditions that people were being held under. And so that's not nothing, right? And I think we need to take a moment to celebrate that. And at the same time, we need to remember a few things around that, that like we can celebrate that and maintain a sort of materialist analysis of what's happening and what this all means in terms of the other parties that are acting on upon Syria, right? So one thing I think really important to remember is that this person who has now taken over Syria, right, Ahmed al-Shara, previously known as Mohammed al-Julani, also maintains prisons like that, right? So those Saydnaya type prisons like are also, a feature of the area of Idlib that he's been controlling for quite some time. And despite initial assurances that that this transitional force, would only be in place for 3 months, right? They originally said that it was a caretaker government managing Syria until March. And none of us really believe that, but now what he's saying is that no, never mind. It's not going to be till March. It's actually going to be 4 years before we draft a new constitution and do a census and et cetera, et cetera. So, what we're seeing, very clearly is in a lot of ways, Western countries and Israel on some level embracing this new government, right? Because for all of the Assad regime's many, many faults, there was a refusal for normalization with Israel. And that refusal was wasn't like grounded in a deep sense of principle, right? Like the Assad regime tried many times actually to work out a peace agreement with Israel, and they just never managed to make it happen. But nevertheless, right, it did maintain itself as a state that was, at its, on its sort of operational strategic level, highly opposed to Zionism. Meanwhile, what we're seeing now, right, there was an interview in NPR last week with the governor of Damascus, the new governor of Damascus, who specifically said, like, Israel is not our enemy, right? We want a friendly relationship with our neighbor, while this country had been invaded and bombed the heck out of Syria for the past 2 weeks, and is still controlling a large chunk of Syrian land. It's almost, beggar's belief. And they've walked back that statement a little bit, but I think we can see a lot by how the US government and other Western powers are treating the new Syrian government, right? This new Syrian force on the ground, and the sort of legitimization that they're giving this guy in his, like fancy Western London tailored suits, right? They're like, you read news reports calling him the president of Syria, right? Which is not a thing. Like, he's not the president. He hasn't been elected by anybody. Right. And even just the way that they refer to what they now call the Syrian government versus what used to be the Syrian regime, So like Assad was a regime, but this, Al-Qaeda affiliated militia that took over the country is somehow a government. Like, I don't know. And that's not to say that the Assad regime was better, but what we are seeing is, I think, a hope and an expectation among Western powers that there's something more friendly in place now that will be open not only to Western investment, right, particularly around rebuilding money and things going back into the country, but also normalization of relations with Israel. So that's something we definitely have to keep an eye out for. And of course, the other piece of this is there's big implications for how Hezbollah will be able to arm itself in case this ceasefire collapses. Right, which the Hezbollah has said publicly that the arms transfer pipeline that they used to receive from Iran through Syria has collapsed, so that it no longer exists. And so, it's not inconceivable that Israel will see this as an opportunity to sort of advance their gains even further, right? That if there's less military capability to restrain Israel, then it will act in an unrestrained way. We've seen that for the, entire 70, 80 years of its existence.
Thank you, Samir. I'm going to pivot a bit and ask a question about what's happening locally. There have been lots of solidarity efforts, solidarity movement over the past 15 months plus to the last 20 years between indigenous, local indigenous communities and you mentioned earlier about the lack of accountability with the US government. That's definitely a theme in failing to hold themselves accountable. And so all of these recurring themes of genocide and militarization. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that. We're entering into 2025, into a new regime, a new government. in the US, and what does that look like for our communities? What does that look like in terms of the current organizing with AROC and locally in the Bay Area?
Yeah, thank you for asking that, Morningstar. That's such an important question. It's, of course, something that's been on our minds, you know, for the past few months. And I think we should have no illusions about the fact that things are going to get very, very hard for Palestine organizing in this country. And they've made it very clear, you know, we see written out in great detail in documents like the Project Esther plan put out by the Heritage Foundation, that there is a concerted effort that will be in place to identify and target and criminalize pro-Palestine activities in the United States. And I think, you know, living in a you know, ostensibly blue state like California and an ostensibly, you know, progressive area like the Bay Area, we should not assume that that does not apply to us. It absolutely will apply to us. And so, you know, I think there's a couple of things that people need to keep in mind here. Well, more than a couple, frankly. One is that this is a bigger plan than one that just involves, you know, the destruction of the Palestine movement, which they clearly want to do. But there's a recognition that that movement is tied to broader movements for liberation and justice, right? That they identify Palestine organizing as a particularly vulnerable attack point. But there's no reason not to assume that once, you know, if they successfully manage to dismantle our Palestine organizing systems, the next thing that they're going to go for is, you know, racial justice organizations, and then after that, environmental justice organizations, and after that, gender justice. Like, you know, it's a clear attack across the left, and the, you know, the tip of the spear is the Palestine work. And the way that we need to make sure that that doesn't happen is by maintaining a broad revolutionary solidarity across our entire movement, right? I think we're going to see some more like center-left organizations try to distance themselves from talking about Palestine as a way to save themselves. And that is not the strategy, right? That's not how they win. That's how they divide us and then take us all down. So maintaining that unity of purpose, I think, is going to be critical in this coming year, particularly as this genocide, you know, worsens, becomes harder to sort of pretend that it's not taking place, you know, the evidence is right in front of our eyes. And so we need to maintain that consistency of vision and purpose to be able to really move things materially. And the way we move things materially here as it relates to Palestine is, of course, cutting off the weapon shipments to whatever extent that we can. And, you know, that's not to say that things were good before Trump or before he comes into office in 2 weeks. You know, it's worth noting that once again, Joe Biden is using his, you know, tiny remaining crumbs of political capital. You know, in his last 2 weeks now in the office, he's just authorized another $8 billion in weapon sales to Israel. And like, that is the lifeline for the Zionist occupation, right? That there's no question that when we can stop those arms transfers, that is when we stop Israel's aggression, right? In Palestine, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Yemen, in Iraq, and beyond. And that should be a real clear focus for us. You know, if we want a demilitarized society here, we need to make sure that we're also working towards demilitarization globally, right? Like the ways that Israeli militarization affects communities like brown and black communities that are policed here is a bigger topic than the few minutes we have together, but something I think folks are probably familiar with. So there are opportunities here if we can maintain that strength of focus, right? And I think particularly as, you know, Trump will inevitably fail to resolve the crisis that this country is facing, we need to be ready, right, with a vision of a better world and how we're going to build that world. And we need to start building it now instead of just being on the defensive. So our work is cut out for us, but it's going to be a rough few years. But, you know, what can come out of those few years, I think, is actually really inspiring and the most potential, I think, for meaningful change at a global scale that we've seen in a long time.
Thank you for that. Yes, with Project Esther, I think there's just a lot of pressure and tension that's being felt. And I'm just wondering what recommendations that you have. We know that, you know, the relationship building, the organizing that is needed, and really showing up for one another as we have been, but what recommendations do you have, and does AROC have in general, in challenging the pressure that is currently being felt by the efforts of Project Esther?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, I think like there are a few answers, some more involved than others, but at its core, it's the idea that we keep us safe, you know? And, you know, I would encourage folks, if you're not already part of organizations or movements, to make sure that you're, you know, organized, right? The way that they defeat us is by atomizing us. And the way that we win is by building a sort of collective power that they can't crush. And so I think it's really, really important that folks plug in and get involved. You know, there's organizations like Bay Resistance that provide opportunities for folks that aren't otherwise directly involved with an organization to be part of like a bigger movement space. And so if anyone is not doing that, I think, you know, now is very much the time. To sign up, to get involved, to show up, you know, not only to show up for the rallies on the streets, although those are, of course, critically important, but in the sort of building, right, the building work that we need to do to create a sort of community resilience, right, to stand up against the mass deportations that are coming, that is going to require organized collective effort. And so, yeah, my one recommendation above everything else is, you know, find people you can organize with. Find people who have been doing the work and plug into those movements that already exist. You know, there's so much more that we can do when we're doing it together and we're aligned in purpose. In addition to that, you know, I would say this is a time, if folks aren't already doing it, to pay a little bit more attention to their own security, right? And that includes things like digital security, which I think, you know, folks have historically been a little bit lax with. And it's really, really important, right, that it, particularly if you are involved in organized spaces, right, that if your devices are compromised or you're compromised in some way, that puts a lot of other people at risk. And so make sure you're obviously, you know, using Signal, and make sure you're using a VPN, make sure your phone's got a privacy screen. These are like really basic things that you can do that may have really important implications down the line. And it's better to do them now before you need them versus later when you realized you needed them earlier.
We have been speaking with Samir Arabi, a member of Arab Resource Organizing Center, who co-hosts the weekly Palestine Solidarity Announcements every Friday at noon. Thank you so much for joining us, Samir.
Thanks, Morningstar. Always a pleasure.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.